You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, good morning and a happy Thursday to you. We're going to jump right into the show. The whole college cheating scandal is evolving and, dare I say, not in a good way.
The Lead.
Yeah, you knew it was coming. You knew it was going to happen, and it has. We now have two Stanford students, and they have filed the first class action lawsuit in the largest ever college admission scandal.
Here we go.
These two students are suing USC, Yale, University of UCLA, and a couple of other institutions. Why they didn't get in? One student says she had stellar standardized test scores and athletic talent. The other was an exceptional student and athlete. Both feel as though their Stanford degrees are now worthless because employers are going to question whether they were admitted like others.
I'm not going to say it's funny, but can we just acknowledge they are currently enrolled at Stanford University?
Yeah.
Which, I don't know a lot about colleges, obviously.
It's a tough one to get into.
Not easy.
Yeah.
Considered a prestigious college, right?
It's what a lot of these parents paid to get their kids into.
But they're saying because they didn't get into Yale, in the one girl's case, that she has somehow been harmed. She is a victim in this entire scandal.
Erica Olson and Kalea Woods are students at Stanford and accused their school and others of negligence. Olson and Woods said they paid admission application fees to several schools without any warning that unqualified students were slipping in through the back door through the fraud, bribery, cheating, and dishonesty alleged by federal prosecutors. Their lawsuit said the universities failed to maintain adequate protocols to guarantee the sanctity of the college admissions process. The students said they're entitled to full restitution of their application fees plus compensatory damages.
Okay, a couple things here.
Okay,
one, if you
this.
Take a look at what the FBI has charged these 50 people, including 33 parents with, there's no university that's been implicated. They did not go after Stanford or Yale or Harvard as being complicit in this scheme of fraud and cheating.
There were some coaches or administrators that were
individuals,
thank you.
But not the universities themselves. So I think it's going to be very difficult in a court of law for these girls to go after the university for not informing them that the system is rigged, because the universities can hide behind the fact we didn't know.
How are we supposed to know that the water polo coach was doing this?
On the flip side,
by the way, we
didn't
even know we had a water polo coach.
We all know that there are big donors that make huge donations to universities, and their kids probably get a second look or a third look more so than, say, my kid.
Legacy admissions. But okay, so let's leave those out. Let's leave out the moneyed people.
Okay.
Should these two girls who currently attend Stanford and say, well, we really didn't get into the school we wanted to because the whole system's rigged, be angry at the football team, the basketball team, the baseball team?
Why?
Well, they claim, these girls, that they had stellar grades. Impeccable.
Probably did.
Public service.
Okay.
We're on the cross-country team, whatnot.
Congratulations.
The quarterback of the football team has about a 1.3 GPA, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe got an 800 on his SATs combined.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a really good football player, and he got in instead of you. So what's your argument? If your argument is that less qualified people got into a college other than you, I would argue, yes, they did. Is that proof in and of itself? Because it is not a merit-based. They've gotten away from merit-based for a few reasons, but it is not the smartest kids go to Harvard. That's not how it works.
We wish it did.
And I think, do you? Because even Harvard, some of the big schools said, if we went strictly by like GPA, you know, in the 4.4s, like you hear about, kind of still don't understand, literally don't understand how you can get over 4.0. The schools would be predominantly, they would be disproportionately Asian, disproportionately white, and that other students coming from challenged backgrounds where their education system would never have an opportunity because they could never get to that level.
I get the argument. I am a merit-based type of person when it comes to jobs, when it comes to admissions, when it comes to it's the best candidate. And you know what? That might not be me. I understand employers and colleges taking the best person for whatever job or whatever applicant. You knew this was happening, though. You knew this was going to happen. These students are now suing because they didn't get in. And they're saying that somebody else undeserving got their spot. Mm. And you know what?
Probably.
There is somebody out there who didn't get into these colleges because of this scheme and this cheating. But was it them?
How do you prove that?
So if I'm a judge and I have these two young ladies come before me in the court of law, I would acknowledge, yeah, you know what? You did pay your admissions fee. I looked it up.
What was it?
The admissions fee to Yale is $80.
80 bones to apply.
I would tell these young ladies, you get $80.
Get your $80 back.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? You want your $80 back? I'll give you your $80 back.
I see
you. And I'll also give you this life lesson. Life isn't fair.
Life isn't fair. And that's where I guess I'm coming from on this. The idea that college admissions, which we acknowledge is subjective. I saw a piece the other day talking to college admissions, the people like sit around the room and debate which kids get in at some of the big prestigious schools. And it struck me, this is completely subjective. This person, I liked their essay more. Oh, this person had more to overcome. It is completely subjective. And I think, by the way, I think the money part is just another part of the subjectivity.
I'll share a story with you here. Those that have listened to the program for a while know that I'm a proud graduate of ASU. Go Devils! ASU wasn't my first choice.
Was it your safety school?
No, it wasn't my safety school. I want to get out of the snow and cold weather. But initially, my first choice was Penn State. My sister was at Penn
State. Backyard.
Yeah. My sister was in Penn State. I always thought I'd go to Penn State. And guess what? I didn't get in.
Oh.
My sister got in 3 years prior. We had relatively the same GPAs. I had a little bit more extracurricular activities. If you're looking at us on paper, we were about the same.
Okay.
She got in. I didn't.
Why?
I have no idea.
But exactly.
And
they were prejudiced against blondes.
My dad, I have no idea. My dad does not have millions of dollars to donate to the university, but he had said, well, you know what, reapply as an agriculture student because ag was a big major at ASU, and they'll take you. And you can go part-time and, you know, maybe we'll get, like, you know, an apartment near campus. And I looked at him, I'm like, Dad, if Penn State doesn't want me,
ouch,
I don't want Penn State.
Ouch.
I'm going to ASU.
Look at you.
Now, granted, here's the thing. That one decision, you can look back on your life and have one decision or one experience or one instance change the trajectory forever.
Sure.
Had I got into Penn State, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now.
No, probably not.
I wouldn't be married to Chris.
You met him here.
And I wouldn't have my daughter, Riley.
Right.
It turned out awesome that I didn't get into Penn State. So all of these kids that are looking, I didn't get into Yale. I didn't get into Harvard. I didn't get into USC.
And it's because the system jobbed me.
No. You know what? Make the best of your situation. I love Arizona. I am so proud to be a Sun Devil. That is part of what happened to me. It's not who I am. And I'm so thankful for what it meant later on down the line.
So can I add this in there now? One of the actresses, and again, I never watched Full House, never saw one of them, so I'm not.
It was an awesome show.
Lori Loughlin turned herself in yesterday and posted bail. $1 million bail. Hold on a second. Can we just back
up
for a second?
Wait. What? How much?
$1 million bail. You're going with 10%, right? But still.
Does Aunt Becky have that kind of cash?
Apparently, because she's out on it. Here's the deal. Are we comfortable? And I understand the outrage and all this, but where's the proportionality?
What do you mean?
Is Lori Loughlin's $1 million bail, wasn't R. Kelly's a little less than that? Or was are we putting them on the same level? Are we putting moms who tried to spend the disposable income they had to get their kid into the school of their choice for whatever reason they wanted, are they on the same level as child molesters, murderers? Like, we're going to get $1 million bail for a mom because she tried to bribe her kid to get into USC?
How sad is this? I'm trying to find out what R. Kelly's bail was, he's just been arrested.
He's been arrested
times
so many times
in the last couple of days.
But how do you know?
I don't know which bail we're talking about.
But you understand my point.
I appreciate the argument.
But you understand my point. Like, I proportionality.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to treat, because I heard they're facing up to 10 years in jail.
No, they're not.
Are you kidding me?
No, they're not.
Like, should there be a punishment? I'm fine with a punishment. I'm fine with the idea they broke some laws. I get all that. But where's the proportionality?
Are we going to walk around arresting parents for giving their kids a leg up. This was cheating. This was fraud. You should be held accountable. A judge is going to have to determine what that is. I don't think it's jail time.
Yeah. And $1 million bail? Really?
Yeah.
Really? I want to say R. Kelly had $1 million bail because he couldn't make it. Remember, wasn't it R. Kelly couldn't come up with, you know, the 10% for $1 million bail?
Yeah, okay. Because
R. Kelly is accused of molesting children.
Several.
Multiple. With videos. I don't put these crimes on the same level.
Neither do I, man.
They shouldn't be spoken in the same sentence, for God's sakes. Okay. Would you go on a honeymoon by yourself?
Whoa.
Okay, isn't that defeat the purpose of honeymoon?
You're doing it wrong.
I was going to say, that literally is the opposite of a honeymoon, if you ask me. But there's more and more people who are actually vacationing by themselves. See the world alone.
St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, 45 minutes from now, I would ask you to set an appointment to join us, but I also understand some of you have life going on, and we're going to make sure we have it up on our podcast to listen to later. We're going to spend an entire hour, because we think it's a heck of a lot more important than a 15-minute talk.
It's critical.
About teen suicide, and what is happening, and there is an uptick. Why is it happening? We have some experts maybe to help us understand it. And what can you do? Maybe to help or quite honestly save the life of a friend, a family member, a loved one. We hope that you'll walk away with some tools. We're going to spend the entire 10 o'clock hour doing that. So just about 45 minutes from now.
Yeah, right? Join us. You're not going to want to miss it. We all could benefit from it.
So I am, although I'm not married, I do understand the concept of a honeymoon. And I can tell you that there are certain sorted things that come into my head when you talk about going to a honeymoon. But usually it's off they go in a limousine. You throw rice. Apparently there's rice is involved somewhere. Then they get on an airplane and they go to some beautiful island location. And then they send us pictures for a week holding hands.
You're so old school. It's not rice anymore.
You
it's
don't
bubbles.
Throw rice?
You blow bubbles.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, exactly. Like, where have you been? My goodness.
I'm in the rice generation.
Oh,
apparently.
My God. Yeah. You're so old school.
We can't throw food at them anymore.
Well,
we have to
you know
throw
what?
Bubbles.
You know what else is old school?
What?
Actually taking that honeymoon together.
What do you... Okay.
Until honeymoon do we part. We've got...
Can we call it a honeymoon if you're not going on it with your spouse?
I think you make a great argument for that. So we've got some newlyweds that are now vacationing on their honeymoon apart from one another. We have one couple.
This is not going
to
end well.
The wife went to Canada and the husband went to France with his friends. No joke.
We got married. Honey, have a good time in Canada. I'm out. Going to Paris. Knock yourself out.
Tell your buddies I said hi. She says neither of us wanted to be where the other one was. We each came back to Dublin, that's where they lived,
yeah,
full of stories, buzzing of our trips, truly delighted to see each other again to share the memories.
Okay.
It was the perfect, imperfect honeymoon.
But it's just not a honeymoon. Can we acknowledge
that? It's a vacation.
You guys went on separate vacations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a honeymoon.
You happened to do it right after your wedding.
Which is odd in and of itself.
Like, it is.
I've spent so much time around you getting ready for this wedding that as soon as the wedding is over, I would like a week-long break from you.
Yeah, I mean, like, even if you've been living together for years, like so many people do before they decide to get married, which isn't unusual. Chris and I did that. When you get married, there is still a transition. Okay?
Yeah.
There is most definitely still a transition. And it's a huge transition. I think the only thing that it would be bigger than that is when you bring the kid home from the hospital with your first baby and you're like, now what? Like the two biggest milestones.
Think about that. Honey, congratulations on the birth of our child. Oh, my God. Let's get some pictures. All right. Well, you have fun. I'm going on vacation. You go home with the baby.
Oh, guess what? You're not coming. The doors and the locks are changed by the time you get back, Bucko.
Now, maybe it's not as extreme when you talk about a honeymoon, but the idea that you would take your honeymoon away from your spouse, I think, defeats the purpose of a honeymoon.
Yeah.
From exactly the sorted things that run through my mind, what the honeymoon is. This is not, that's call it what you want, but it's not a honeymoon.
But we're finding that more and more people are doing things on their own.
Ronery. I'm so ronery.
Oh, Americans, not just some outlying newlyweds, but a lot of Americans are just traveling alone, more so than ever before. Solo travel is on the rise. About 25% of us say that we would rather travel by ourselves than with someone. I had a college roommate, Shannon, who every year for her birthday, she would travel somewhere. And she always traveled alone. She didn't want anybody to go with her.
On purpose.
It was on purpose.
So like, Shannon would go, hey, I'm going to Costa Rica. Go, great, can I come?
No. No, it was exactly what it was.
What?
She loved to travel by herself.
Really?
And she loved the experiences of doing what she wanted to do, when she wanted to do it, how she wanted to do it.
I need to learn this.
And for me, well, I mean, to each their own. I mean, if newlyweds want to go this way or if you want to go travel on your own, that's fine. I'm all for like the 1 or 2 days, hey, reset, let me get away from everybody just to kind of have a moment to breathe. But when it's a true vacation, I want that shared experience. I want that shared experience with my husband.
That's what I struggle with. I like
having somebody
there. I wish I had the confidence to travel more on my own. But part of it is because I don't like you're standing there by yourself going, this is great. I got no one to tell about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no one to share it which makes it less of an experience for me. I don't know what that says about me.
I think you're human.
But these people don't feel this. These large numbers, percentages of people travel on their own. They don't feel the need to share it with others. It's about them. And I can maybe that's a strength in and of itself. One that, of course, I don't possess. Is there really a crisis at our southern border, an emergency? The Senate is getting ready to vote, and it looks like it might be a bit of a rebuke against Trump's executive order. We'll talk about that next on Arizona's News Station.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
A reminder, coming up in just about a half hour, the entire 10 o'clock hour we will dedicate to the growing concern, the growing issue of teen suicide. The numbers are staggering and they are devastating. And each one is more than a statistic. It is a family that has changed forever.
It's a ripple effect.
And schools. And we're learning that. So we have some guests coming in, and we're going to be talking and also getting some of your thoughts and some of your personal stories. That's coming up at 10 o'clock today, the entire hour dedicated to the crisis in our community, in our backyard, of teen suicide. Speaking of crisis, Pamela, you know we have a crisis on our southern border. It's an emergency, I tell you. And the Senate is, we believe, will be voting today. We'll be voting today on a measure that would overturn Trump's emergency declaration.
Yeah, he declared an emergency down along the border, which meant he did not need to get congressional approval for the money that was going to be moved around. Well, you've got Congress that controls the purse strings.
Per the Constitution.
Exactly. And that's what this is coming down to. Yeah. It's not about the border and whether or not there is a crisis on the border, because I can argue that there is. Is it a national emergency? I don't know. But we live in Arizona. We can all acknowledge there is most definitely a problem along the border. What we cannot agree upon are the solutions. So there is a problem along the border. But what the president has decided to do with declaring a national emergency has ticked off some Republicans because it is overstepping the bounds of the Constitution. And that's what it appears they're going to check him on today.
And if you're counting, if you will, as people are trying to count the votes, there is apparently 7 as of right now, if I counted right, and not everyone has weighed in, don't get me wrong, but 7 Republican senators who said they will vote to overturn, stand in the way of this emergency declaration, which would mean that Trump would then have to veto that bill and it would go back to the Senate. They would need
60
to overturn the veto, right?
Exactly. And this morning, the president invited some of those Senate Republicans to the White House. They sat down for about a 2-hour conversation. Yeah. A lot of it was about trade, but this also came up as well. And the president acknowledged that, you know, the GOP helping to overturn his national emergency declaration is on his mind. So this morning, here's what the president had to say about it.
I don't know what the vote will be. It doesn't matter. I'll probably have to veto. And it's not going to be overturned. And we're going to have our whole thing. It's been the legal scholars all say it's totally constitutional.
No. So is what the Senate is doing totally constitutional. So if they get 54. Maybe 55.
Is that what it would be?
Yeah, if I understand correctly, it's a three person majority 53-47. So if seven of them are walking across the aisle, you're at 54-46, Greg. I hate when I have to do that.
Yeah, you're
right. Let's just go with it.
46 plus.
If there is a veto, you
plus
need
seven?
To pick up another six.
No, wait. It's 47 Dems.
Currently, plus
okay.
seven Republicans. 54.
Okay.
Then you would need to come up with more. And I think it's plausible that there are Republican senators out there right now who, I would argue, hopefully are rightfully concerned about the oath of office they took to the Constitution, who say this is not how emergency powers are supposed to be used. We do control the purse strings. We did pass a spending bill that gave money for border security. We did our job. He just doesn't like the number we gave him. You may have more come back if they get to, can they overturn the veto?
That's the thing. And the president himself has told, you know, allies and folks around D.C. that he does not want to be embarrassed by a Senate vote on the national emergency resolution that garners over 60 votes.
And so a lot of this is kind of, if you watch the House of Cards, there is the vote counting going on behind
yeah.
the scenes right now.
Yeah.
And
what's it
going to
take?
They don't like holding votes that they don't already know the outcome of.
Sure.
And so Mitch McConnell, as leader of the Senate, already knows the outcome, or believes he does, of what would happen. Where are we today? What would happen if? You know, they kind of play all the scenarios out. And how does that make them look? And so there is wrangling going on. Although Senator McSally here says she's been promised certain things in return for her vote.
You broadly said those FY19 projects across all the country will not be impacted by this, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Correct, Mr. Secretary?
That is correct.
Yeah, she wanted to get some assurances that funding wouldn't, you know, come from the military projects in Arizona for this border wall, because that's what the emergency declaration would allow the president to do, dip into some of that military funding.
It's coming from somewhere.
She just wanted assurance that it's not coming from Arizona.
Well,
and so last month she had said,
I share the president's goal. I share his frustration. And I really wish it didn't come to this.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of people wish it didn't come to this.
Here we are.
And we are. And I think that there is a bigger discussion. To me, this isn't about border security. It is about the power of the Oval Office, of the executive branch. And I would hope Republicans would check the president on the overstep of this power, because there is a great argument to be made, and it's the one that the Republicans that are standing up to the president on the side of the Constitution are making, is if you get a Democratic president in office, 2020, 2024, whatever it may be,
it'll happen.
Eventually, yeah, whether it's this next cycle or a few down the road.
And if you look at demographics, it'll happen sooner than later.
Okay, fair enough. And you don't like their politics, as Democrats don't like, you know, Trump's politics.
Right.
What would the next Democratic president do to overstep their boundaries?
This is about the process, this is about the system, and this is about the Constitution of the United States of America.
Right.
And if being pro-Constitution, pro-law, makes me anti-Trump, okay. Well, I think it says more about you than it does about me, but I'm in favor of the separation of powers. I'm in favor of Congress having the purse strings and the different branches having to work together and come up with some sort of compromise to get things done. Not one side saying, I'm going to do it unconstitutionally, even if the other ones say I can't.
We're going to keep an eye on the vote. We're going
to
keep an eye on how
McSally
votes. Yeah, it's expected to happen today, and we'll bring you that information.
I told you that we're going to take a deep dive, a much closer look at an issue impacting teens and schools all over the valley. Why are so many teens committing suicide? We're going to talk about that and get ready for our 10 o'clock hour. That's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Coming up at 10 o'clock today, we are going to dedicate an entire hour of the show to a vitally important, crucially important issue, and one that is decidedly uncomfortable to talk about at times.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Because we need to talk about it.
Suicide, and more specifically, teen suicide. Acknowledging and understanding that we have seen a pretty dramatic statistical uptick right here in the Valley.
It is the leading cause of death for kids 10 to 14 years old.
The leading cause of death
in Arizona
between the ages of 10 and 14 is suicide. Not falling off your bike and bumping your head, not drowning in the pool, not a car accident. Suicide.
It's the second leading cause of death in people in Arizona, 15 to 34. Now, it's not just about the statistics. We're not doing it because of the statistics. Bruce and I had a conversation a couple weeks ago. We were encouraged by what was going on down at the state legislature. We know that the Senate has passed a bill that would mandate suicide prevention training for educators in from 6th to 12th grade. If you are interacting with students, you're going to have some sort of training to help spot the problems, what to do when they come towards you. And we thought that that was really good.
That's a good step.
But 3 hours every 3 years, really, how much of a difference is it going to make? Yeah. I'm not going to chastise them for doing it. I think it's a step in the right direction, but we need to do more. So Bruce and I asked ourselves, what can we do to do more? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we have these discussions because the face of suicide is not the face you may think. This is something
regardless of what you think it is.
This is very personal to me. It's very personal to me because 6 years ago, I was sitting in the news booth right over there as an anchor for your show.
Yep.
And my phone was blowing up. I'm getting chills right now even thinking about it. I had my phone in my purse, and I usually have it in the studio with me, and I didn't that day. And I went after a break, and I grabbed it, and I mean, oh my gosh, my phone was blowing up. And then I went on my email, and Mom, call me. You need to call me. My sister, Pamela, I need to hear from you. My dad, everybody. Talked to my mom, and she said, Art, my sister's husband of 3 months had committed suicide that morning. I had gotten the notification while I was on the air, and I learned what it meant to be a survivor of suicide. 6 years ago, my sister became a widow at the age of 38, and it has touched my family in ways you couldn't even imagine.
It's still dealing with
still, it. Still, you can hear it in my voice. And then you and I decided to do this because it is a critical issue for our state, for our parents, for our kids. And upon our decision to do this morning, yet again, we learned that suicide touches people you don't necessarily think it would. So I want to invite into the conversation right now our very own Jim Sharp from Arizona's Morning News, because Jim, I was struck driving into work this morning and hearing you share your story.
And
thanks for being here sharing it, because I know that takes tremendous strength.
Well, yeah, you know, here's the thing is I figure if I can say something about it, then maybe it might show other people they can talk about it. And it has to be talked about. It has to be talked about. So
the stigma still exists and surrounds it, without a doubt.
Yeah, and we were talking about that Senate bill that you mentioned, and the fact that you all were going to be talking about teen suicide, which I think is an incredibly important topic, at 10 o'clock today. And I mentioned a close family member who's actually been pretty open about this, but I don't feel like it's my place to just kind of lay it all out there for them. But as a teen, they tried to commit suicide, and then as an adult as well. And they had mental health issues. They still do, but they have got the right dialed in medication now. Life is really, really good for this person. But then I said, you know, maybe I should mention what happened to me. And I caused it to happen to me, which was I had knee surgery.
How old are you at this point?
I would have been 16, maybe 17. It was between my junior and senior year. And I came home with a bunch of – it came down to Phoenix to have the surgery done. And we drove back up to Page, where I went to high school. And I had a bottle of pills, and I just used a couple, and then they got put away. I had a big blowout fight with my parents, and I don't know. There was some self-loathing going on, and I just like, I'm going to show them. And I ate that bottle of pills, and I went and my mom figured it out. I think I kind of did it in a dramatic way. I left the bottle just laying on the floor, kind of a thing.
The true cry for help that you wanted somebody to know.
But you know, I went and hid in the attic of our house. I didn't want to be found. But then somehow or another, embarrassment caused me to emerge. My mom called, and the fire department showed up, and they're like going, "Hey, Jim, where are you?" You know, and I finally just I felt like an idiot. I just like, "I'm here," and they took me to the hospital, and they sat me down with a counselor. You know, first they gave me some, you know, something to make medicine, me throw up. They call it pumping your stomach, right, but they actually just give you something that makes you puke. And then I'm sitting there talking to the guy, and he's like, you know, I'm like, "Well, life's like this and life's like that." And he's like, "Yeah, that's great. But what did you do? What did you take? And is there anything else we should know about?" And I'm like, "No." And I went home. I went home and I slept on the couch for 2 days, essentially. You know, because I had so many opioids in my system. Yeah. And I don't, to this day, I couldn't tell you an exact specific reason why I decided to do that. Now, we moved every year until I was 11. We moved to Arizona, and every year we moved. I was the new fat kid at school for several years. And then we moved to the Navajo Nation, and I was the new fat white kid. And so there's a lot of reasons. My father left when I was young. I mean, a million reasons why why this.
None of them justifying taking your life, though.
Yeah.
Is part of the argument, right?
But I think people that take their lives, sometimes they don't even really know why they're doing it at the last moment.
Concept of the impact.
Yeah.
Jim, thank you. Nope. Genuinely.
Thank you guys for talking about this. It's so important.
But to have the strength to share that story is going to impact lives. I know that because by sharing our story, my story, has impacted lives. And that's what we're hoping to do today.
Yes, please.
Helping parents have that conversation with their kids, maybe on the way to soccer practice today. We're going to be diving into that because it is a critical issue
for
our state.
We have guests lined up. And again, our hope is in the next hour, you'll have some takeaways, maybe some tools that you can use to help a friend, a family member, a loved one. It's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.